Welcome to Silicon Bites episode 42. And at last, it seems we have a run of good news with the passing of the US aid package, the massive $61 billion aid package to Ukraine, passing today. It is expected to go through the House. And the UK has followed that by announcing an aid package of its own, not as significant, of course, in terms of monetary scale, but it does contain some really important announcements about types of munitions. Now, we're going to come to that in a minute, but first, we're going to cover the story which has really inspired the title of this episode. And it is the story about how Russian troops are trying to storm Chasiv Yar with its estimated about 20 to 25,000 soldiers. Budanov has announced that Ukraine will face a difficult situation from mid-May, and that is for a variety of reasons, including, of course, this renewed attempt by Russia to claim Ukrainian territory and to strike a significant propaganda win, at least in the framing that the Kremlin uses. Around 20 to 25,000 Russian soldiers are trying to storm Chasiv Yar and the settlements in the city's outskirts, it was reported. Chasiv Yar lies about 10 kilometers west of Bakhmut in the Donetsk Oblast and 50 kilometers north of Avdiivka. Russian troops have been focusing their efforts near Chasiv Yar, which they see as crucial for further advances towards Kostyantynivka, Kramatorsk, and Slovyansk, the Ukrainian military has said. Ukrainian troops are fighting off Russian paratroopers from the 98th Guards Airborne Division and the 217th Guards Airborne Regiment in the area near Chasiv Yar. Russian troops are using their classic tactics of constantly storming Ukrainian positions, but apparently are failing to gain a foothold. However, we know from previous stories that this will also exact a terrible price in human life on the Ukrainian side as well, as they seek to defend against waves and waves of meat attacks from the Russian side. And this is where I think it's important to note the title of this. Moscow has not relinquished any of its aims, even though its war serves little purpose, even though it is only inching forward, painfully slowly, and taking small slivers of Ukrainian territory, is expending a huge amount of materiel and personnel in doing so. As new munitions, both in terms of scale and capability, are provided to Ukraine, and as Ukraine starts to ramp up its own mobilization effort, which is off to a halting start, we'll have a look at that in a minute, it's likely that Ukraine will be able to resist the incremental advance of Russian troops, but they won't stop. That will exact a huge price in terms of Russian life. And whereas we have little sympathy for the invading army, the army that is committing extraordinary and terrible atrocities, nonetheless, the sheer horror of death and trauma on that scale would tend to make most normal politicians think twice about their actions. But we should understand that the Kremlin does not work on the same framework. It does not think like us. It does not use the same calculus as us. And it is deeply imbued with paranoia. It is puffed up by the sense of its own power. It has a sense also that it is somehow eternal, invincible, inevitable. But I think Moscow will break on Ukrainian resistance. It will break on Ukrainian will to fight, especially if the Ukrainians have Western capabilities, weapons, munitions at scale, which looks likely over the coming days and weeks. So let's cover that story next. The House has approved $61 billion aid for Ukraine. What we know so far, asks The Guardian. The US funding package has cleared its biggest hurdle, the House of Representatives. What comes next in the Senate is more of a rubber stamp, and that is expected to go through today. The vote in the end was overwhelming, which of course leads us to ask why it has been blocked for so long, when in fact there was a majority support from it across both Republican and Democrat parties. Eventually, the Speaker, Mike Johnson, helped marshal the plan through its passage and said of the vote, "We did our work here, and I think history will judge it well." Well, in the euphoria, people are letting Johnson off, forgetting perhaps that for 6 months, more than 6 months, he has been instrumental in blocking the passage of that bill, in blocking aid for Taiwan and Israel, and indeed in blocking what was a comprehensive deal on security for the southern US border as well, essentially playing politics not just with Ukrainian lives, but with American domestic security as well. Finally, something seems to have changed his mind. There is a lot of speculation about what that might be. Moscow papers are suggesting that it is brainwashing by William Burns, the CIA director, by Democrats, by security services, etc. But the answer may be a little more prosaic than that. It does seem that finally, Mike Johnson and others have been meeting real Ukrainians, have been actually exposed to genuine stories of the torture and suffering that Ukrainians are undergoing, especially the evangelical and Baptist community. Could it be that in telling personal stories, it's possible to overcome Russian propaganda? Only time will tell. And of course, we need more information to be able to understand what has gone on behind closed doors to cause this radical change in the political landscape of the US, which has allowed this aid package to be unblocked. Well, in the next episode of Silicon Bites, we are going to be looking at the Russian church as a vehicle for spies and killers, but also the acts of Russia in suppressing religious minorities. In fact, any religion that is not Orthodox Christianity under the Moscow Patriarch in the territories that are conquered by the Russian Federation. That is the theme of the next episode. Let's return to the aid package. The package includes several Republican priorities that Democrats have nonetheless endorsed in order to get the aid package passed. Those include proposals that allow the US to seize frozen Russian central bank assets, to rebuild Ukraine, impose sanctions on Iran, Russia, China, and criminal organizations that traffic fentanyl, and legislation to require the China-based owner of the popular video app TikTok to sell its stake within a year or face a ban in the US. This I find absolutely fascinating because some of these Republican measures are actually far more aligned with an idea of victory in Ukraine, and they are far more specific, such as seizing Russian assets, that will actually help to bring about a victory. It can only be hoped that through further cooperation between Republicans and Democrats, we can move beyond the phase, the damaging phase of Republican obstruction, but also Jake Sullivan's extremely divisive, misconceived, and dangerous tactic of managed escalation, or rather managing the risks of the Ukraine war, and in so doing, exacting a terrible price on Ukrainians and making them weaker. So let's break this aid package down. This is a similar story in the Kyiv Independent. The aid package provides 60.84 billion of assistance to Ukraine, including 13.8 billion for Ukraine to buy advanced weapons, 13.4 billion for replenishing US stockpiles, 11 billion to support US allies in the region, and another 13.8 billion to purchase US defense systems for Ukraine. This is a game-changing package of munitions and support. And as has been stated before, the majority of this money will end up actually being spent in the US because it is largely US munitions that are being provided, and those stocks have to be replenished. Those factories and warehouses will need to be restocked with weapons. That, of course, does create US jobs. And in the end, it makes the US stronger on the international scene. But we have to remember, as substantial as this aid package is, it may well be the last one for some considerable time, given that we're in an election year and there is a certain amount of uncertainty about the outcome of that election and indeed the intent of one of the potential candidates in that race, who is, of course, undergoing various court proceedings in the US at the moment, but it's really not certain what's going to happen there. And despite the aid passing, we have to remember this has put a real question over the long-term reliability of the US. A quote here from Stokes, a visiting fellow at the German Marshall Fund, said, "The month-long delay only raises questions anew in foreign minds about whether the US is a reliable partner. Passage of the bill finally allays some of those concerns, but the concerns will not go away, and nor should they. This should be a rallying cry for Europe to step up. In fact, Germany is the second largest provider of weapons to Ukraine. The UK is the third in terms of unilateral aid. And if you look at it, not in volume terms, if you look at it as a proportion of population, actually, the contribution of many European countries per head of population is actually considerably higher than the US. It's important to note. Also, William Burns, the CIA director, has recently said, and this could be one of the spurs for the vote passing, that Ukraine could hold its ground through 2024, challenging Russia's recent advances and blocking their potential major offensives that are expected in late spring or early summer. So this is absolutely critical timing. And again, this should be a wake-up call for Europe, not to look at this US aid package and think, okay, well, that's done the job. Now, European and American partners should be thinking about what is provided to provide cast iron security for Ukraine to make sure it's not overrun, but also be thinking about what they need to provide in order to deliver a victory. I'm going to be talking about these topics in more detail with Jessica Berlin later in the week. That conversation is going to be a strong rallying cry for Europe and other allies to do a lot more. And as William Burns concludes, there is still, however, a significant risk of Ukrainian defeat without this aid package and without subsequent aid and support. The picture remains dire. Ukraine still faces troop shortages. And even with the renewed weapons that are going to be provided, Ukraine is still up against Russia. That is likely going to be mobilizing around 30,000 people every month of this year. That's according to the UK Defence Ministry. And it is reportedly firing at the moment shells at a ratio of 7 to 1 compared to Ukraine. Now, of course, that figure alone isn't the most important one. Accuracy is also more important. Defending forces potentially have the advantage in terms of how effective firing of munitions can be. And those odds are likely to improve over the coming months as US shipments and allied shipments start to hit the front lines and replenish the stocks that are nearly depleted, it is reported, right across the front line on the Ukrainian side. And to conclude, this article points out that the passage of this new aid bill for Ukraine will directly benefit at least 71 US cities in terms of creating new jobs and reviving various production lines to create weapons, both directly for the war and for the US military as well. And let's put this in some perspective. This $61 billion aid package brings the total that the US has provided since Russia's full-scale war to $44 billion. But that's important here. We're in the third year of the war. To date, the US has provided $44 billion. So actually, this 60 is a substantial injection of resources and hopefully capability for the Ukrainians. Let's also look at the British aid package, because whereas it is monetarily far smaller, it does contain some incredibly significant capabilities. Rishi Sunak has promised the UK's largest ever military support package for Ukraine. This includes equipment such as 400 armored vehicles, 1,600 weapons, and 4 million rounds of ammunition. Of course, that's going to be a mixture of small arms ammunition as well as larger calibers and artillery shells. Plus, there's another £500 million in funding. This is the UK's largest ever military package for Ukraine, and it comes with a warning to Vladimir Putin, not only to end the war of aggression against Ukraine, but to not think about going further. Rishi Sunak suggested that Russia would not stop at the Polish border if Russia was able to overrun Ukraine. He made this statement while meeting with the Polish leader Donald Tusk in Poland this week. As well as the 4 million rounds of ammunition, there are 1,600 missiles, 60 boats, as well as an additional 500 million in military funding. This takes the UK total provided for this financial year up to 3 billion, making the UK one of the staunchest and most substantial allies for Ukraine. And crucially, some of those missiles include the legendary Storm Shadow, which has been involved in some of Ukraine's most notable successes over the last year, including strikes against the Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Sevastopol. The Ministry of Defence will also send what has been described as the largest ever single package of equipment from the UK to help push back the Russian invasion on air, land, and sea. It's unclear exactly how much this is going to cost, but it will come from existing MOD budgets, which of course we know have been under some considerable strain. And let's turn to another Ukrainian win. And this is the extraordinary story about a reported strike by Ukrainian Neptune missiles against a Russian warship, Kamyona. And this is a special ship. When I read this article, I could barely believe what I was seeing here. Now, this is not just a museum piece, this is a very capable and useful vessel. We'll come to those details in a minute. But the Kamyona is one of the oldest working military ships in the world, if not the oldest. It was launched in 1913, a number of years even before the Bolshevik Revolution. She served in the Russian Imperial Navy, the Soviet Navy, and finally the Russian Federation Navy, surviving two world wars. It is by far the oldest active warship in the world that is still performing in a frontline role. And of course, it's been said that this vessel has been extremely lucky to have survived this long and actually to remain in practical use. But that luck may have finally run out. On Sunday, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry claimed its forces had hit the 315-foot Kamyona with locally made Neptune cruise missiles while the ship was moored in Sevastopol in Russian-occupied Crimea. It's unclear how bad the damage is, but even moderate damage could put that aged vessel out of action for months or even forever. It is another black day for Russia's Black Sea Fleet, as all of its surface vessels are rapidly being promoted to submarine class. And as this article in Forbes states, Kamyona is irreplaceable in several different senses. It's a naval time traveler, time capsule from a bygone era, a museum exhibit that incredibly is still in use generations after other vessels her age have long turned to scrap. And in losing Kamyona, the Black Sea Fleet also loses a critical capability. Kamyona is a twinned-hulled catamaran, basically a ship with a huge open space in the middle. Now, from that, her crew can launch and recover miniature rescue submarines or lift objects such as pieces of sunken vessels from the seafloor. And of course, Russia has an awful lot of that scrap lying on the bottom of the Black Sea right now. When a pair of Ukrainian missiles sank the Russian cruiser Moskva in the Western Black Sea in April 2022, Kamyona and her AS-28 mini sub reportedly helped recover parts of the wreck and the bodies of the cruiser's crew. This rescue and recovery capability is extremely useful for the Black Sea Fleet. It also, of course, helps with the repair of submarines potentially, which can surface and then be worked upon within the hull of this vessel. But as a naval expert has noted, yes, Kamyona is a precious historical artifact, but no, that does not give it special status in the middle of a brutal war zone and in a war of aggression, of territorial acquisition that Russia has launched against Ukraine. Every single Russian asset on the sovereign territory of Ukraine is a valid target. And there may be more bad news for the Kremlin here too. In a lengthy article in The Spectator, the journalist Colin Friedman asks, could Europe send troops to Ukraine? What may turn the tide is not just the long-awaited F-16s or Washington switching the funding back on. It could be the presence of thousands of European troops across Ukraine's western half, protecting cities, ports, and borders, making Ukraine feel reassured and unnerving Russia and blunting its advance across Ukrainian territory. This article paints a picture of 2026 when the tide has turned, and indeed the atmosphere has changed as European countries pile on and not NATO, but Europe sends troops en masse to protect the free parts of Ukraine. Now, this is an interesting, if not highly speculative, read, but I think it's important that people start to really think now. Think about what victory means, think about how it might be achieved, think about what kind of resources and political will is required to make it happen. So, this is an interesting article. Link to it will be posted in the description of the video. And another topic which we're going to be discussing in a future video is the question as to whether Boris Johnson really sabotaged peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Spoilers, I don't believe he did. I don't believe Russia is a credible negotiation partner, but there is quite a lot of speculation about that at the moment. This is an article from The Guardian, which suggests that the collapse of so-called peace talks might be more nuanced than was originally thought. This very much reflects an article that was produced in the Foreign Policy Journal by Sergei Radchenko and Samuel Cherub. That is an article and a hypothesis which I think is deeply flawed and again will be examined in a standalone episode on this channel. And even that report points out that there was no ready-made, almost baked deal for a ceasefire in spring of 2022. In fact, the two sides were extremely far apart. There was no deal for Johnson to blow apart. There was no agreement on territorial issues. There was no agreement on the levels of armaments permitted after the war, and no agreement at all about any kind of responsibility or reparations for the extraordinary crimes that Russia had already committed by that point on the territory of Ukraine. And it was during those talks that the news of Bucha and Irpin broke and the appalling mass murder of Ukrainian civilians. So, whereas I disagree fundamentally with a lot of this report, it may be interesting to dig into it in a bit more detail and to see which parts of it potentially align with Russian talking points, because you can absolutely bet that Russian propaganda really does try to weaponize and utilize the idea of failed negotiations, of a failed peace, even if that wasn't realistic. That is a key part of a lot of talking points that you see with pro-Kremlin commentators. But we'll examine that in more detail in another episode. And as if we needed it, here is a reminder as to why we need to push back against the Kremlin and that its aggression is not simply focused on Ukraine. Here's an article from the Kyiv Independent that talks about the thousands of European flights that are reportedly affected by suspected Russian jamming. Now, if you haven't heard about this, this is a fairly significant story, but one which has very much passed under the radar, as it were. Thousands of flights to and from Europe have been reportedly affected by suspected Russian jamming of GPS systems. Some 46,000 aircraft have reported problems over the Baltic Sea since last August, with most of them occurring in Eastern Europe near borders with Russia. Russia's been accused of jamming GPS signals in nearby countries such as Finland as far back as the 2010s, and several recent high-profile incidents of jamming have highlighted the issue. Most notably, Russia is believed to have jammed the satellite signal of a Royal Air Force aircraft used to transport Defence Secretary Grant Shapps recently. That was dated on March 13th when the Defence Secretary was travelling back to Britain from Poland. That aircraft was jammed for about 30 minutes as it flew by Russia's Kaliningrad region. Aircraft rely on GPS for navigation, but the Civil Aviation Authority in the UK have played down the risk to passenger safety. Aviation is one of the safest forms of travel, they say, and there are several safety protocols in place to protect navigation systems on commercial aircraft, etc. Now, that is certainly playing down the issue, but what we need to look at here is what Russia is doing in other circumstances. And if we weren't afraid of the nuclear threat to Russia, these kind of moves, in combination with other offensive actions, could easily be taken as a kind of declaration of war. And I think we're trying to play this down because if we were to accept that hypothesis, then all sorts of responsibilities and actions would naturally have to follow on from that. Well, we are starting to see the threat from Russia being taken a little more seriously. We are not yet seeing Western powers really thinking about how it can be tackled comprehensively and how Russia can be defeated, or how a curtain of freedom could be thrown up across Europe to deter, deflect, and lock out the autocratic aggression coming from Russia. And this is another story which I think is quite linked to it. Again, the Kyiv Independent, the Swedish Navy chief says that Russia's shadow fleet of oil tankers is quite possibly conducting espionage in the Baltic Sea. Now, we've talked in a previous episode about this grey fleet and the extraordinary environmental risk that it poses to the precious environment of the Baltic Sea, which could now be described as a NATO sea. But Russia's shadow fleet of oil tankers is possibly conducting espionage in the Black Sea, as well as helping circumvent sanctions on the Russian oil trade, said the Swedish Navy chief, Ewer Sug Haslum, in comments for the Swedish public broadcaster. The shadow fleet refers to an aging and largely uninsured fleet of oil tankers that Russia uses to transport oil above the $60 per barrel price cap. So it's breaking sanctions and putting, I would say, the marine coastline and environment at extreme risk. It should also be noted who has helped Russia put that fleet together. And there is an implication that Greek shipping magnates have played an outsized role in helping to create that fleet of old hulks that allow Russia to fuel its war effort. Haslam said that some of the ships from the shadow fleet have been found to possess communications and signals equipment not normally associated with cargo vessels, leading to concerns that they could be used in hybrid operations. The equipment could potentially be used in intercept communications or other forms or acts of sabotage, she added. Beyond their use to bypass sanctions and possibly conduct espionage, there has, of course, been concern that the shadow fleet could be a potential threat to the environment. The Financial Times reported in November last year that Denmark could start inspecting and potentially blocking the transit of Russian oil tankers operating in its waters without Western assurance. Now, it's time for governments to stop talking about this and start implementing measures. We need to re-exert rule of law and re-exert international norms in areas where Russia operates. And if it flouts those, then ways must be found to block them. And lastly, let's reinforce why this is so important. Russia is conducting a terroristic campaign of violence and trauma right across Ukraine. Russia is attempting to create an outsized panic in Kharkiv, for instance, to force the mass exodus of civilians, reports the Kyiv Independent. Russia is a terrorist state. Judge it by its actions. Its actions are terroristic, and its words, if you parse the words in Russian propaganda and even in the Russian mainstream media and printed press, there is a lot of terroristic threats contained within those. Russian forces and Kremlin propagandists are conducting a combined effort to destroy the city of Kharkiv and cause a mass Exodus of Civilians, the Institute for the Study of War reported on April the 22nd. Moscow has recently intensified attacks against Kharkiv using missiles, the dreaded glide bombs and drones to destroy infrastructure and kill civilians. These are being combined with information operations designed to sow panic amongst the civilian population while fueling rumours of impending Russian ground offensive to take the city. Now, this may not be realistic in military terms, especially as Ukraine starts to replenish its stocks of munitions and hopefully people with the upcoming mobilization. But it does not stop Russia making those threats. And it continues to lob weaponry into the fray and to destroy civilian infrastructure, buildings, educational and cultural centres right across the area, and especially in Kharkiv itself. And indeed, Russia's attacks on the energy infrastructure are having an effect to depopulate Ukraine. It's driving people towards cities that have more robust air defences like Kyiv, or to places which are not hit nearly as frequently and are further away, such as Lviv Oblast. This is an extended article by the Kyiv Independent that points out this terroristic targeting of Ukrainian energy infrastructure is not just an attempt to terrorise the population. It's also an attempt to create an empty space, purged of Ukrainian life, purged of Ukrainian civilians, purged of Ukrainian laughter and security, language, literature, culture. It's designed to force an ethnic cleansing of the Ukrainian lands, to create a security buffer zone, and to create an area that Moscow can pillage at will. We absolutely must not let this happen. And finally, yesterday, as part of that terror campaign, Russia partially destroyed the Kharkiv TV tower, as you can see in the image here. Russian forces struck Kharkiv's television broadcasting tower on April the 22nd, causing the top half of the mast to collapse. The governor of Kharkiv Oblast reported that the television infrastructure had been attacked and explosions were heard in the city. And if you watch Ukrainian news on X, you would have seen a lot of commentators, some of whom, including the academic Jade McGlynn, who is currently in Kharkiv, that sound of the explosion was heard right across the city. There are interruptions in the digital TV signal at the moment, say the local government. The structure was partly damaged and engineers are now working to try and restore it. But we have to put this in context. What is Russia doing? Russia is against Ukrainian culture. It is against Ukrainian people and language, but it's also against Ukrainian resistance and truth. And of course, wherever it goes, Russia will try to destroy the infrastructure and indeed the voices that express any views other than those which the Kremlin wants people to hear. This is quite simply a struggle between an authoritarian regime that seeks to silence people and impose its own Orwellian truth on the world, against Ukraine, which may be an imperfect democracy, but is a country that has a robust civil society, which has an incredible culture of debate and discussion, and does not repress voices, does not repress religions, does not repress opinions, or suppress political agitation or organization. Ukraine is on the side of right, Russia is wrong. And if we were to let Russia win in Ukraine, then it would promise a dire future for freedom, democracy, and indeed it would stifle innovation, wealth, and indeed happiness for generations to come. Because Russia is a deeply, deeply unhappy and traumatized place, and we cannot let it project its negative, nihilistic, destructive, manipulative, and controlling values onto Ukraine, Europe, and the world.